Rich Dad Poor Dad. It's a book that many have said has changed their lives, but others don't agree with some of the concepts. So, after not picking it up for years and years, we've gone back and picked out the key lessons, but also the things that we just don't agree with.
Welcome to the Property Podcast, where every Thursday morning, property investors come to be informed and inspired. This week, as Rob said, we're revisiting a book that's probably the most influential in property investment circles, but is controversial as well. I was surprised when going back and reading this book for the first time in years at some of the things that I'd forgotten, some of the things that I'd misremembered, and some of the ideas that I'd just accepted on first reading that now I'm really not at all sure about. So in this week's episode, the five key lessons from Rich Dad Poor Dad that you need to know, and the two things that you should be very careful of.
So this week's news story is a 22-page report by HomeTrack on the rental market right now, and it's a quarterly report. Now, don't worry, we're not going to go through all 22 pages. Unfortunately, the BBC website has done a good job of summarising the key takeaway points from this report. But it's interesting, Rob.
It is interesting for lots of different reasons. There are lots of cities where rent is up, but actually wage growth has been really strong this last year. So even though there are plenty of cities where rents have increased, there are actually only three UK cities where rents have risen faster than wages, so renting has become less affordable. And those are in Nottingham, where rents are up 5.4%, and also Leeds and Bristol, where they're both up 4.5%. So rents growing fast in those cities, presumably because of high demand. But there's also a really interesting mixed picture down the bottom of the league, Rob.
Yeah, so at the very bottom, and by some way, is Aberdeen. And we've touched on Aberdeen before. It's a very interesting market, but its market really fluctuates depending on how well the oil market is doing. But also down there, the mix of areas is really strange. You've got Coventry, Middlesbrough, but then mixed in with that, you've got Newcastle and Oxford. And normally we like to give you a takeaway and say, well, that's because of this reason. But on first glance, we're actually struggling to see why the mix is that mix. Up at the top is the usual suspects, the places that we'd expect to see. You've already said Nottingham and Leeds, Rob, 1 and 2. But also up there, you've got Edinburgh, York and Sheffield also making the top 10. Manchester just outside at number 11. And it's nice to see so many of the places that we name checked at the beginning of the year, Rob, as places to invest, being included in that list. So we like this news story.
Just before we get into our main topic this week, in case you hadn't noticed, we had a new YouTube video out yesterday. Yes, it's called How to Invest £50,000 in Property, and that's probably one of the most common questions we get asked. So you'll want to check out the video to find out how we answer. You'll find a link in the show notes, and make sure you subscribe to the channel so you don't miss any videos we put out in future. We are Property Hub UK on YouTube, or just search Property Hub. This week we are dusting off the pages of the book that gets name-checked more than any other by property investors, and that is Rich Dad Poor Dad by Robert Kiyosaki. This book was first published over 20 years ago now, in 1997. It sold over 32 million copies, it's been a New York Times bestseller, it's launched a whole series of books as well as products and courses, and it's been endorsed by Oprah, Will Smith and Donald Trump, which he's probably not boasting about as much as he was when the book first came out. So today we're going to go back and explore why this book has been so influential. We're going to be talking about our experiences with the book, and we'll recap some of its main lessons and what we think of them now with the benefit of hindsight.
So in essence, this book focuses on the importance of financial independence and financial freedom. And it also talks about why it's so important that you should build on your own financial IQ for you to be financially successful. And in this story, Robert Kiyosaki talks about a rich dad and a poor dad. Now, there's been debate whether this is a true story, partly true, fictional. For me, it doesn't matter whether it's true or not. The way the story is told makes the lessons of the book so much more digestible. So you have his two dads, the poor dad and the rich dad. And it's about their mentality and how they conduct themselves with finances. So his poor dad believes that you should work for money. You get a job, one job, and you stay in that job. And a person's wealth will be largely determined by their family background, and their circumstances are difficult to change. It's what's given to you. Whereas the rich dad in the book advises Robert Kiyosaki to get a job, but to learn skills so he can be more successful as an investor or an entrepreneur. And wealth comes from experience-based learning and then eventually multiple streams of income. And the reason why it's so loved by property investors is property investment can be one of those multiple streams of income. So that's the setup, that's the book. It's A Rich Dad and a Poor Dad and the lessons taken from both of them. So Rob, before we get into what we feel are the most important lessons from this book, it's fair to say that this is a book that often makes a huge impact on people's lives. And you will hear property investors, whether it's at meetups, online, or just bumping into people and chatting about property, that Rich Dad, Poor Dad has an effect on the majority of people who pick it up. And that's been no different for ourselves.
Yeah, it really did that for me. And it's been really interesting going back and reading it again now to see where that came from. I think the real power of this book is the story and how simple it is. It does just feel like you're reading a story and the concepts just kind of get slipped in there almost without you noticing. And it all sounds so simple. And that's what really struck me when I was reading it. I had this book recommended to me way before I had any interest in property. My friend Matt recommended that I read it. And I actually remember reading it on my way to the job that I was working in the time. It was my first job. I think I was earning about 15 grand a year at the time. I was absolutely nowhere near having any multiple streams of income or any properties or anything at all. But I just remember reading this book and just thinking, wow, yeah, this makes sense. Because it's laid out in a way that just makes this all seem so obvious. And once you've read it, it just seems so obvious. Like, yeah, of course that's how you should do things and the way that things should be. But I'd never encountered those ideas before, or at least I'd never encountered them in a way that was simple enough for me at the time to understand. So even though I didn't rush out and start doing incredible property deals straight away, it did have a massive impact on my thinking.
And it was exactly the same for me. I was fairly young when I picked up this book. I'd left school, left all formal education at that point. It was one of those first books I picked up when I'd started to do self-development, to pick up education outside the traditional system. And I was amazed on a couple of levels. The first, like you say, Rob, is that actually most of it, the content is fairly obvious, but when it's put in front of you, you're like, of course, this makes sense. Why haven't I framed my thinking this way before? But then also it whet my appetite for thinking, what else have I not learned through school? Why am I now a young adult and I'm really learning these lessons for the first time? So it's a combination of excitement and also a bit of frustration, like, why did I not know this? Why is this information not more widely out there? And then I went on from that point to ferociously consume as much as I could on the subject of business and property. And that journey's never ended, and it hopefully never will. It's something I love doing today, is learning and constantly improving. But that book was in the first handful of books that I picked up that started off this journey for me. So you do hear the term, oh, life-changing or game-changer thrown out a lot, but it's not too dramatic to say that. It had that impact on us both. And as we've said already, many others who pick up the book feel the same too.
So let's get into some of the lessons from the book. We've gone back through and we've picked out five of the things that we consider to be the most important points that this book makes. The first of those is be in control of your finances. Your employer or the government will not. So this is the start of the reprogramming, really. I think a lot of people have this vague sense that if you get a job, then your employer will look out for you. It's steady, it's safe, and then later in life, you'll be taken care of by the government. Actually, these days, that view probably isn't so widespread, but 20 years ago, it absolutely was. So Robert Kiyosaki's message is no, employers won't take care of you, the government won't take care of you, you have to take care of yourself. And it's about taking responsibility and reprogramming the way you think around money. So one of the things that he talks about, which is really simple but really powerful, is one of the things that his rich dad said to him is you should never say, I can't afford it. When you say, I can't afford it, that shuts down your creativity. Instead, you should change that into a question and ask, how can I afford it? Because then it presupposes that there is an answer and you just have to find it. So it gets you thinking about what you could do instead. So that's just one small example of this fundamental concept of changing how you think about money so you are the one who's in control.
Another thing that Robert Kiyosaki talks about a lot is the rat race. And basically, that's the corporate ladder, if you like. Robert Kiyosaki is not a fan of the rat race. As we've already said, he is a fan of being employed to learn skills and develop yourself. And that's a good thing. Being in work and chasing another promotion and then believing once you get this thing in your work life, you'll then be happy, is wrong. And I agree with him. It is wrong. If you think another promotion, another pay rise is then going to equal happiness, it's not. If you can't find happiness in what you do day to day now in work, chances are you never will if you carry on the same path you're on. Now, you have two options. You can find something that's more meaningful to you and more fulfilling, or you can leave the rat race altogether. Now, with the first option, you may be able to just switch roles, and financially, there's no difference in pay. But for some people, their passion may be in an industry or a role that doesn't pay very well. So having the passive income that Robert Kiyosaki talks about is so important. And passive income is talked about a lot in property, but really this is the first place that most people hear about passive income.
Yeah, the term passive income gets thrown around all the time these days. Somehow it's just become part of the general vocabulary. And if you ask most people what they're investing in property for, the words passive income will be in the first sentence that they say back to you. You could debate whether there's even such a thing as passive income because nothing's truly passive. But when people say that, I think what they generally mean is income that you earn that isn't tied to you exchanging your time directly for money. So if your income comes from working in a job or being self-employed, if you stop turning up, then the money stops. And if you want to earn more, then all you can do is get a raise or work harder if you're self-employed. So that's very much active income. Passive income, though, is something that you can set up, and even if you stay in bed for a week, the income will still keep on coming in. It might not do forever, it will need some maintenance, but it's not directly tied to your ongoing efforts or you being in a certain place, doing a certain thing at a certain time. So rent from property, of course, is a really good example of that. Once you've got a property and you've got a tenancy set up, you don't have to do anything in particular on any given day. The money just comes in, whatever you're up to. Now, we mentioned that Robert Kiyosaki is pro having a job, and we'll come back to that idea later as well. He's not saying all your income should be passive, but the point he makes is that having passive income, of course, makes you wealthier, and it gives you more options as well. And all these years on, Rob, with the people we come into contact with, we've seen this working out for people.
Yeah, this is one of the great things about working in property is listening to people's stories of how they've achieved this and what they've done with that passive income. But I actually like the way you framed it, Rob, and having those options, because that's what passive income does. It gives you options. It gives you the power to have choice. You may love what you do today, but if you stop loving what you do, you can stop working for a while and then decide about what you want to do next. Having that peace of mind because of passive income is a fantastic tool. I remember working with an investor, Neil, if you're listening, hi, who worked in the city, and he hated his role, so much so that he told me pretty much every time we spoke how much he hated working in the city, despised his role, but it was really well paid. So he built up a property portfolio and got to the point where he could stop work altogether. So he did. But after 6 months, he realised he was bored and he didn't want to not work. He just didn't want to do the work he was doing. But he loved bikes, absolutely loved cycling. So he went to work in his local bike shop, part-time, and loves it, loves his role, loves the fact that he gets paid a modest income to talk to people about a subject he loves. Now, that's power. To be able to work in a role or an industry that you love, and it doesn't matter if it pays well or not, is a fantastic position to be in. And that's why passive income is so sought after by property investors. Now, a word of caution. We've connected property and passive income together a few times this episode already. But Rob, not all property investment is passive. And actually, a lot of it isn't passive. And that's a common misconception that people have, is they think property investment is passive income. But in many cases, it's not.
Not at all. So if you take your standard buy-to-let, so you buy a property, you rent it out, and then other than having to fix things occasionally and deal with changes of tenants, the rent just keeps coming in. That's passive. That's as passive as it gets. Like I said earlier, there's no such thing as truly passive, where you set something up and you never need to give it a moment's thought ever again. But that's pretty passive. There are plenty of types of property investment, though, that are totally not. That might be something that you really enjoy doing. It might be something that you'd rather do than the job that you do now. But it's still a job. It is in no way passive, because even if you're not the one installing the new bathroom or knocking down a wall, you're still going to be having to go and find the properties. You'll have to negotiate the sales. You'll have to think about the finance. That's never going to be passive. Then there are things that are trendy at the moment, like serviced accommodation. So you've got properties that rather than renting them out long term, you've got guests who change over every few days. That you can get to a point where it is more passive because you can scale to the point where you've got a team doing lots of the different jobs for you. But in itself, it's certainly not passive. There's lots of work to do with marketing and communicating with guests and doing the changeovers. Again, could be a really good income stream for you. Nothing wrong with it, but not actually passive. So I think that is worth clarifying, Rob, because people do have this idea of just property equals passive when that's not necessarily the case.
The next lesson that we think is really important that everyone absorbs from this book is the concept of good debt versus bad debt. For those who are completely new to this, the concept of any debt being good is a strange one. But actually, if you can take on a debt that allows you to buy an asset that then pays you more than the debt repayments itself, then that is a good debt. In property investment, we often call that a mortgage. So you will get a buy-to-let mortgage. You may have to pay back £200 a month. But if your rent is £450 a month, as long as your costs aren't too high, then that is a good debt. That is something worthwhile doing. A bad debt is taking a loan to buy a car or go on holiday. You may enjoy what that debt gives you, but then the only things you own from that point on are a memory or something that's sitting on your driveway that's depreciating in value over time and costs you money to run it. So that truly is a bad debt. Now, the controversial point, and the one that people like to debate, is the fact that your home, the own home you live in, if you own that, it is not an asset. And Robert Kiyosaki points that out in his book. And I remember myself taking a while to absorb this and even agree with it. This is one of the contentious points for me. But over time, I've definitely come in line with his viewpoint on this. And that if you buy a home, it's not paying you back. Yes, it can go up in value, but while you own it, you're going to be spending money on it and also spending money on it that may not be efficient. So you may buy the sofa for your home that you really love and costs £5,000. But if it was a buy-to-let, you may go, well, that £2,000 one is perfectly reasonable. You overspend on your own home. So it's not just the fact that you buy it, you're paying a mortgage and it's never paying you back, but also the fact that you're pouring money into your property and having to cover any refurbish or maintenance costs as well. Your home really isn't an asset. Hopefully one day your property might be worth more, and that might be worth more than everything you've put into the property, but it might not. So therefore, your home is not an asset.
Yeah, the whole thing about your home is not an asset is debatable, because you could argue, well, you've got to pay some kind of housing cost, and if you're not paying your mortgage and all your costs for your own home, then you're just paying rent, and that's not an asset either. But I think even though you could argue with the point, it's a really valuable point, because it does upset people and it does get you questioning this default view that your home is an investment, even your best investment, your most important investment, many people think. So making you see that it's actually draining money out of your pocket rather than putting money into it is a very important idea. And this whole notion of good debt and bad debt was probably what struck me the hardest from the whole book. Because avoiding liabilities, I was very much on board with. I was never really one to go out and spend money on things that I couldn't afford. But I had this general concept that debt is bad. All debt is bad. And this was the first time I encountered the idea that debt can be good if it's buying cash flowing assets rather than liabilities. So it's another of those ideas that's very simple when you understand it. And indeed, now it's fairly commonplace. It's been spread around a lot more over the last 20 years. But at the time when this book was first written, this really was something very new that can completely change your thinking in a very positive way.
Now, another lesson that the book teaches you is the concept of not splashing out on luxuries when you're not in a financial position to do so, and that you should build up your passive income that then allows you to go and buy these luxuries and goods, but do it that way round. Don't go buying the expensive holidays or cars before you've built up a solid financial base, and live within your means until you're in that position. But so many people don't follow that. And actually, since this book was published, you could argue that this has got worse, especially with the world of social media we live on now. Some people like to portray that they are possibly doing better than they are and will show off their lovely cars and fancy holidays. But in many cases, that's built on little or no financial backing. It's all done on debt. Now, I'm sure you can think of people who live this way. I certainly can think of people who live this way. But the book talks about how you should be disciplined financially and make sacrifices in the short term, so longer term, you can live that way without financial pressure. And Rob, this relates to the concept of paying yourself first, which is another controversial point in Rich Dad Poor Dad. I completely understand why it is controversial, because I don't fully buy into this lesson. I think a watered-down version of paying yourself first is the right way to go. But Robert Kiyosaki takes it a lot further.
He does, and you're not the only one. I've spoken to a few people who've had a problem with this idea of paying yourself first, because it does sound a bit mad at first. So here's a quote defining pay yourself first, not from the book, but from something else that Robert Kiyosaki's written online. It says, in order to be rich, you must have the self-discipline to pay yourself first. By this, I simply mean using your income to invest in cash-flowing assets before you pay your bills or buy anything fun. This, in turn, will create more income that you can use to invest in more assets. Paying yourself first is not easy. In fact, it can be scary, especially when the bills are piling up, but you must develop the self-discipline to do it. Now, worded like that, it does sound pretty insane. It's like, okay, so I've got all these bills that I can't pay. The debts are racking up, but they'll have to wait because I've decided that I'm going to allocate this much money into investments. Doesn't in its strictest form make a lot of sense, especially if you've got debts that are racking up at a higher interest rate than the investments you're making are earning you. But you mentioned a watered down version, Rob, and I think that makes a lot of sense because the concept of putting investments first makes lots of sense. The mistake that most people make is investing what's left over. And there's very rarely anything left over. If you earn a certain amount of money, most people can find a way that all of it needs to be spent on various things that they consider important. So you manage to justify the fact that you have to go out for all those meals and drinks, and then you get to the end and there's nothing left to invest. This is flipping it and saying that you have to put investments first. That's your number one priority. Everything else comes later. And I think making that mindset shift is actually really powerful. If you can set up an automatic transfer that at the start of the month when you get paid, whisks a certain amount of money away into a savings account, takes it out the way before you even have a chance to see it, that does actually make loads of sense. But what doesn't make sense is sticking to that blindly when you've got bills racking up that you haven't paid. So I think it's another one of these areas in the book, and there's a few of them, where in the interests of simplicity or making a point as powerfully as possible, he'll say something that doesn't strictly make sense all the time or takes it a bit far. But rather than saying, oh, that's stupid, and then just throwing out the whole idea, you have to take the core lesson from it and then figure out how to apply that in a less black and white kind of way so it works for you.
So that's something we don't fully agree with in the book. But you can take something from it. But Rob, there are some things that we just don't agree with at all in the book. And one of those things in the book that Robert Kiyosaki talks about a lot is just these amazing deals that seem to drop on his lap and he expects everyone else to be able to do and deliver as well. It's unrealistic at best and possibly for most people a bit of a fantasy.
Yeah, this is where I start to have a real problem with Rich Dad Poor Dad, because it actually surprised me when I went back and read it after a number of years that he was not saying go start your own business. That's kind of what I remembered the book as saying, but it actually doesn't. It says don't start a company unless you really want to. It's really, really hard. Instead, just keep your job, keep a job that you learn from and that you can progress in, and invest on the side. That's fine. I think for most people, that's really good advice. But the problem is, some of the deals that he thinks you can be doing on the side just seem to set totally unrealistic expectations. So here's a quote from the book describing one of the deals that Robert supposedly did. He says, instead of shopping with local real estate agents, I began shopping at the courthouse steps. In these places, a $75,000 house could sometimes be bought for $20,000 or less. For $2,000, which was loaned to me for a friend in exchange for $200, I gave an attorney a cashier's check as a down payment. While the acquisition was being processed, I ran an ad advertising a $75,000 house for only $60,000 with no money down. The phone rang hard and heavy and the house sold in a few minutes. I asked for a $2,500 processing fee, which I used to return the $2,000 to my friend with his additional $200. In the end, $40,000 was created in my asset column. Total working time, 5 hours.
Rob, we've been doing it wrong.
Clearly.
Do one of these a day, we're sorted.
Yeah, all we need to do is head down to the courthouse and snap up one of those 75,000 houses for $20,000 using a loan from a friend. I mean, I'm not saying that he didn't do this. I'm not saying that it's impossible to do this. But what I am saying is for most people, doing this on the side in most phases of the market, it's not normal. So if you come away from this book going, well, all I need to do is put 5 hours aside so I can create $40,000 using one of these deals that's around, you're just going to be completely disappointed. And there are countless examples of this in the book. Again, not saying it can't be done, it can. But for most people, most of the time, no.
And that really links on to another thing about the book, which we really don't like, which is the fact that a whole seminar industry has been built around his book and his brand. So not so much in the book itself, but now the brand Rich Dad Poor Dad and how it's used. Because you will see the Rich Dad Poor Dad advertised on the internet, especially if you've done anything property related. You may see Rich Dad Poor Dad taster courses for a couple of hours for free. And if you think, well, actually, if this is going to be a course about the book and really building on the lessons in the book, then fantastic. But it's not. It's a sales funnel. And that sales funnel doesn't stop there. In that 2-hour course, they then sell you into a weekend course. In that weekend course, they then sell you into a more expensive course again. And it goes on. Before you know it, you've invested 5-figure sums, serious amounts of cash, into just learning about how to be creating cash. Now, that is a great business for the people who are selling the product. But for people who want to learn about property investment, there are lots of ways you can learn for free or little money. And the real learning will come from investing. So instead of spending 10, 20 grand on courses, spend 10, 20 grand on getting your first property investment and you'll learn so much more. The lessons will be real and it will really accelerate you as a property investor. Even if it's not a great deal, it doesn't matter. What matters is the fact that you start and then your learning accelerates. So a lot of people go on from reading this book and go, oh wow, there's a course on this. And if it was done properly, that would be brilliant. But unfortunately, it's not, and it's something that we just don't agree with. So Rob, there's some great lessons from this, some things that we really think are important. But then, as we've discussed, there are some things that we just don't agree with. So the question is, would we still recommend it to somebody who's starting out?
I still absolutely would, because I don't think there's any other book that's as easy to read that puts these concepts across in such a simple way. And they are really foundational ideas. So if someone's a real personal development junkie, they might not get so much out of this because they'll have encountered a lot of these ideas before. Because over the last 20 years, these ideas have become a lot more commonplace and they've been recycled in lots of different places. But as one of your first books to read about this kind of thing, I think it's pretty hard to beat. I also think it does bear rereading every few years, and I'm glad that we got to reread it to prepare for this episode, because as your own knowledge grows, there are some ideas in the book that at first you might have thought, well, that just sounds a bit crazy. But then with hindsight, knowing a bit more, you can go back and maybe take the main lesson while toning it down a bit or throwing out some of the nonsense around it. And we've talked about some of those examples already. So would I recommend it to someone new? Yes. And I'd also recommend rereading it if it's been a few years.
Yeah. I'd wholeheartedly endorse both points of view, Rob. If you are new to Rich Dad Poor Dad and you're thinking about, should I read it? Then please do. I think you'll really enjoy it. And now you can go into that book with an open mind and also be a bit cautious around some of the things we've given warnings against. But if you have read it, it may have been a long time ago. For me personally, it's been multiple years, possibly even 10. Since I picked up Rich Dad Poor Dad and read it. So going back through the lessons again, it's been great. And even though I consider myself fairly experienced now, it's been great just having those basic lessons reinforced. So whether you're a newbie or you're an old hand at this, give it another go. It's not perfect, but it has changed people's lives. So for that, we have to absolutely recommend it. So Rob, it's no surprise then, our Hub Extra this week is the recommendation of the Rich Dad Poor Dad book. And as a bonus resource, check out Rich Dad Poor Dad 2, The Cashflow Quadrant. Now, Robert Kiyosaki's published a ton of books around Rich Dad Poor Dad, but pick up these two and you'll get everything you need. They're the strongest two. So have a read and let us know what you think. And also, while you're on the web picking those up, make sure you sign up if you haven't already to the Property Hub website, because each and every week we send out an email which we call Hub Extra. And Hub Extra, we aim to make the most valuable email in your inbox every single week. And we give you more resources there. So make sure you do that as well.
So that is us done for another episode of the Property Podcast. Hope you enjoyed this trip down a literary memory lane with us. And let us know what other books you recommend or what lessons you took away from Rich Dad Poor Dad. You can find us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Property Hub UK. And don't forget, we've also got our YouTube channel with even more free education. Just search Property Hub. That's all for now. We'll see you back here on Tuesday for Ask Rob and Rob. Until then, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.